the garland. I've told you that you don't have to say everything. You have to learn that. You don't have to say everything. Why can't Mommy like the things you get from the general without pretending they are from God?
Who says they are not from God?
Auntie Uju asked and made a face, pulling her lips down at the sides.
Ifemelu laughed.
According to the family legend, Ifemelu had been a surly three-year-old who screamed if a stranger came close. But the first time she saw Auntie Uju, 13 and pimply-faced, Ifemelu walked over and climbed into her lap and stayed there. She did not know if this had happened or had merely become true from being told over and over again, a charmed tale of the beginning of their closeness. It was Auntie Uju who sewed Ifemelu's little girl dresses, and, as Ifemelu got older, they would pore over fashion magazines, choosing styles together. Auntie Uju taught her to mash an avocado and spread it on her face, to dissolve rob in hot water and place her face over the steam, to dry a pimple with toothpaste. Auntie Uju brought her James Hadley Chase novels, wrapped in newspaper, to hide the near-naked women on the cover, hot-stretched her hair when she got lice from the neighbours, talked her through her first menstrual period, supplementing her mother's lecture that was full of biblical quotes about virtue but lacked useful details about cramps and pads. When Ifemelu met Obinze, she told Auntie Uju that she had met the love of her life, and Auntie Uju told her to let him kiss and touch, but not to let him put it inside. Chapter 4. The gods, the hovering deities who gave and took teenage loves, had decided that Obinze would go out with Ginnika. Obinze was the new boy, a fine boy even if he was short. He had transferred from the university secondary school in Nsoka, and only days after, everyone knew of the swirling rumours about his mother. She had fought with a man, another professor at Nsoka. A real fight, punching and hitting, and she had won too, even tearing his clothes, and so she was suspended for 2 years and had moved to Lagos until she could go back. It was an unusual story. Market women fought, mad women fought, but not women who were professors. Obinze, with his air of calm and inwardness, made it even more intriguing. He was quickly admitted into the clan of swaggering, carelessly cool males, the big guys. He lounged in the corridors with them, stood with them at the back of the hall during assembly. None of them tucked in their shirts, and for this they always got into trouble, glamorous trouble, with the teachers. But Obinze came to school every day with his shirt neatly tucked in, and soon all the big guys tucked in too, even Kayode da Silva, the coolest of them all. Kayode spent every vacation in his parents' house in England, which looked large and forbidding in the photos Ifemelu had seen. His girlfriend Yinka was like him. She too went to England often, and lived in Ikoyi, and spoke with a British accent. She was the most popular girl in their form, her school bag made of thick monogrammed leather, her sandals always different from what anybody else had. The second most popular girl was Ginnika, Ifemelu's close friend. Ginnika did not go abroad often, and so did not have the air of a way, as Yinka did. But she had caramel skin and wavy hair that when unbraided fell down to her neck instead of standing afro-like. Each year she was voted prettiest girl in their form, and she would wryly say, "It's just because I'm a half-caste. How can I be finer than Zenap?" And so it was the natural order of things that the god should match Obinze and Ginnika. Kayode was throwing a hasty party in their guest quarters while his parents were away in London. He told Ginnika, "I'm going to introduce you to my guy Zed at the party."
"He's not bad," Ginnika said, smiling.
"I hope he did not get his mother's fight in Jinzo," Ifemelu teased.
It was nice to see Ginnika interested in a boy. Almost all the big guys in school had tried with her, and none had lasted long. Obinze seemed quiet, a good match. Ifemelu and Ginnika arrived together, the party still at its dawn, the dance floor bare, boys running around with cassette tapes, shyness and awkwardness still undissolved. Each time Ifemelu came to Kayode's house, she imagined what it was like to live here, in Ikoyi, in a gracious and gravelled compound with servants who wore white.
Si kayo de with a new guy,
Ifemelu said.
I don't want to look,
Gineke said. Are they coming?
Yes.
My shoes are so tight.
You can dance in tight shoes,
Ifemelu said.
The boys were before them. Obinze looked overdressed, in a thick corduroy jacket, while Kayode wore a t-shirt and jeans.
Hey, babes, Kayode said.
He was tall and rangy with the easy manner of the entitled. Gineke, meet my friend Obinze.
Zed, this is Gineke, the queen god made for you if you are ready to work for it.
He was smirking, already a little drunk, the golden boy making a golden match.
Hi, Obinze said to Gineke. This is Ifemelu, Kayode said, otherwise known as Ifemsko. She's Gineke's right-hand man. If you misbehave, she will flog you.
They all laughed on cue.
Hi, Obinze said.
His eyes met Ifemelu's and held and lingered. Kayode was making small talk, telling Obinze that Gineke's parents were also university professors.
So, both of you are book people, Kayode said.
Obinze should have taken over and begun talking to Gineke, and Kayode would have left, and Ifemelu would have followed, and the will of the gods would have been fulfilled. But Obinze said little, and Kayode was left to carry the conversation, his voice getting boisterous, and from time to time he glanced at Obinze as though to urge him on. Ifemelu was not sure when something happened, but in those moments, as Kayode talked, something strange happened, a quickening inside her, a dawning. She realized quite suddenly that she wanted to breathe the same air as Obinze. She became also acutely aware of the present, the now, Tony Braxton's voice from the cassette player, "Be it fast or slow, it doesn't let go or shake me." The smell of Kayode's father's brandy, which had been sneaked out of the main house, and the tight white shirt that chafed at her armpits. Auntie Uju had made her tie it in a loose bow at her navel, and she wondered now if it was truly stylish, or if she looked silly. The music stopped abruptly. Kayode said, "I'm coming," and left to find out what was wrong, and in the new silence, Gineke fiddled with a metal bangle that encircled her wrist. Obinze's eyes met Ifemelu's again. "Aren't you hot in that jacket?" Ifemelu asked. The question came out before she could restrain herself, so used was she to sharpening her words, to watching for terror in the eyes of boys. But he was smiling. He looked amused. He was not afraid of her.
"Very hot," he said, "but I'm a country bumpkin, and this is my first city party, so you have to forgive me."
Slowly he took his jacket off, green and padded at the elbows, under which he wore a long-sleeved shirt.
"Now I'll have to carry a jacket around with me."
"I can hold it for you," Gineke offered. "And don't mind, Ifem, the jacket is fine."
"Thanks, but don't worry, I should hold it, as punishment for wearing it in the first place."
He looked at Ifemelu, eyes twinkling.
"I didn't mean it like that," Ifemelu said. "It's just that this room is so hot, and that jacket looks heavy." "I like your voice," he said, almost cutting her short. And she, who was never at a loss, croaked, "My voice?" "Yes."
The music had begun.
"Let's dance?"
he asked. She nodded. He took her hand and then smiled at Gineke, as though to a nice chaperone whose job was now done. Ifemelu thought Mills and Boone romances were silly. She and her friends sometimes enacted the stories. Ifemelu or Ranyinudo would play the man, and Gineke or Priye would play the woman. The man would grab the woman would fight weakly, then collapse against him with shrill moans, and they would all burst out laughing. But in the filling-up dance floor of Kayode's party, she was jolted by a small truth in those romances. It was indeed true that because of a male, your stomach could tighten up and refuse to unknot itself. Your body joints could unhinge. Your limbs fail to move to music, and all effortless things suddenly become leaden. As she moved stiffly, she saw Gineke in her side vision, watching them, her expression puzzled, mouth slightly slack,
as though she did not quite believe what had happened.
"You actually said country bumpkin," Ifemelu said, her voice high above the music.
"What?"
"Nobody says country bumpkin. It's the kind of thing you read in a book."
"You have to tell me what books you read," he said.
He was teasing her and she did not quite get the joke, but she laughed anyway. Later she wished that she remembered every word they said to each other as they danced. She remembered instead feeling adrift. When the lights were turned off and the blues dancing started, she wanted to be in his arms in a dark corner, but he said,
"Let's go outside and talk."
They sat on cement blocks behind the guest house, next to what looked like the gateman's bathroom. A narrow stall, which when the wind blew, brought a stale smell. They talked and talked, hungry to know each other. He told her that his father had died when he was 7, and how clearly he remembered his father teaching him to ride a tricycle on a tree-lined street near their campus home. But sometimes he would discover in panic that he could not remember his father's face, and a sense of betrayal would overwhelm him, and he would hurry to examine the framed photo on their living room wall.
"Your mother never wanted to remarry. Even if she wanted to, I don't think she would because of me. I want her to be happy, but I don't want her to remarry."
"I would feel the same way. Did she really fight with another professor?"
"So you heard that story?"
"They said it's why she had to leave Nsoka University."
"No, she didn't fight. She was on a committee and they discovered that this professor had misused funds, and my mother accused him publicly, and he got angry and slapped her and said he could not take a woman talking to him like that. So my mother got up and locked the door of the conference room and put the key in her bra. She told him she could not slap him back because he was stronger than her, but he would have to apologize to her publicly in front of all the people who had seen him slap her. So he did, but she knew he didn't mean it. She said he did it in a kind of, 'Okay, sorry, if that's what you want to hear, and just bring out the key' way. She came home that day really angry, and she kept talking about how things had changed, and what did it mean that now somebody could just slap another person. She wrote circulars and articles about it, and the student union got involved. People were saying, 'Oh, why did he slap her when she's a widow?' And that annoyed her even more. She said she should not have been slapped because she is a full human being, not because she doesn't have a husband to speak for her. So some of her female students went and printed 'full human being' on T-shirts. I guess it made her well known. She's usually very quiet and doesn't have many friends."
"Is that why she came to Lagos?"
"No. She's been scheduled to do this sabbatical for a while. I remember the first time she told me we would go away for her 2-year sabbatical, and I was excited because I thought we would be in America. One of my friend's dads had just gone to America, and then she said it was Lagos, and I asked her what was the point. We might as well just stay in Nsoka."
Ifemelu laughed.
"But at least you can still get on a plane to come to Lagos."
"Yes, but we came by road," Obinze said, laughing. "But now, I'm happy it was Lagos, or I would not have met you."
"Or met Ginika," she teased.
"Stop it.
Your guys will kill you. You're supposed to be chasing her."
"I'm chasing you."
She would always remember this moment, those words.
"I'm chasing you. I saw you in school some time ago. I even asked Kay about you."
He said, "Are you serious?"
"I saw you holding a James Hadley Chase near the lab, and I said, 'Ah, correct, there is hope. She reads.'"
"I think I've read them all."
"Me too. What's your favorite?"
"Miss Shumway Waves a Wand."
"Mine is Want to Stay Alive. I stayed up one night to finish it."
"Yes, I like that too."
"What about other books? Which of the classics do you like?"
"Classics? Kwe. I just like crime and thrillers. Sheldon, Ludlum, Acha."
"But you also have to read proper books."
She looked at him, amused by his earnestness.
"Ajebata, university boy! That must be what your professor mother taught you."
"No, seriously."
He paused.
"I'll give you some to try. I love the American ones."
"You have to read proper books," she mimicked. "What about poetry?"
"What's that last one we did in class?
Ancient Mariner. So boring.
Obinze laughed, and Ifemelu, uninterested in pursuing the subject of poetry, asked,
So, what did Kayode say about me?
Nothing bad.
He likes you.
You don't want to tell me what he said.
He said, Ifemelu is a fine babe, but she's too much trouble. She can argue, she can talk, she never agrees. But Ginika is just a sweet girl.
He paused, then added,
He didn't know that was exactly what I hoped to hear. I'm not interested in girls that are too nice.
Uh-uh! Are you insulting me?
She nudged him in mock anger. She had always liked this image of herself as too much trouble, as different, and she sometimes thought of it as a carapace that kept her safe.
You know I'm not insulting you.
He put an arm around her shoulders and pulled her to him gently. It was the first time their bodies had met, and she felt herself stiffen.
I thought you were so fine. But not just that. You look like the kind of person who will do something because you want to, and not because everyone else is doing it.
She rested her head against his and felt for the first time what she would often feel with him, a self-affection. He made her like herself. With him, she was at ease. Her skin felt as though it was her right size. She told him how she very much wanted God to exist, but feared he did not. How she worried that she should know what she wanted to do with her life, but did not even know what she wanted to study at university. It seemed so natural to talk to him about odd things. She had never done that before. The trust, so sudden and yet so complete, and the intimacy, frightened her. They had known nothing of each other only hours ago, and yet there had been a knowledge shared between them in those moments before they danced, and now she could think only of all the things she yet wanted to tell him, wanted to do with him. The similarities in their lives became good omens. That they were both only children, their birthdays 2 days apart, and their hometowns in Anambra State. He was from Aba, and she was from Umunachi, and the towns were minutes away from each other.
Uh-uh, one of my uncles goes to your village all the time, he told her. I've been a few times with him. You people have terrible roads.
I know Aba. The roads are worse.
How often do you go to your village?
Every Christmas.
Just once a year? I go very often with my mother, at least 5 times a year.
But I bet I speak Igbo better than you.
Impossible, he said,
and switched to Igbo.
Amam ata inu. I even know proverbs.
Yes, the basic one everybody knows. A frog does not run in the afternoon for nothing.
No, I know serious proverbs. Akota ife ka ubi, ile oba. If something bigger than the farm is dug up, the barn is sold.
Ah, you want to try me? She asked, laughing.
Acho afu, adiako, nangba dibia.
The medicine man's bag has all kinds of things.
Not bad, he said. Ibo dike no aga uno. Ilo no ogu agu. Ilo taya.
If you kill a warrior in a local fight, you'll remember him when fighting enemies.
They traded proverbs. She could only say 2 more before she gave up, with him still raring to go.
How do you know all that? She asked, impressed. Many guys won't even speak Igbo, not to mention knowing proverbs.
I just listen when my uncles talk. I think my dad would have liked that.
They were silent. Cigarette smoke wafted up from the entrance of the guest house, where some boys had gathered. Party noises hung in the air, loud music, the raised voices and high laughter of boys and girls, all of them looser and freer than they would be the next day.
Aren't we going to kiss? She asked.
He seemed startled.
Where did that come from?
I'm just asking. We've been sitting here for so long.
I don't want you to think that is all I want.
What about what I want?
What do you want?
What do you think I want?
My jacket?
She laughed.
Yes, your famous jacket.
You make me shy, he said.
Are you serious? Because you make me shy. I don't believe anything makes you shy, he said.
They kissed, pressed their foreheads together, held hands. His kiss was enjoyable, almost heady. It was nothing like her ex-boyfriend Moffi, whose kisses she had thought too salivary. When she told Obinze this some weeks later, she said, "So where did you learn to kiss? Because there's nothing like my ex-boyfriend's salivary fumbling." He laughed and repeated, "Salivary fumbling," and then told her that it was not technique, but emotion. He had done what her ex-boyfriend had done, but the difference in this case was love.
"You know it was love at first sight for both of us," he said.
"For both of us? Is it by force? Why are you speaking for me?"
"I'm just stating a fact. Stop struggling."
They were sitting side by side on a desk in the back of his almost empty classroom. The end-of-break bell began to ring, jangling and discordant.
"Yes, it's a fact," she said.
"What?" "I love you." How easily the words came out. How loudly. She wanted him to hear, and she wanted the boy sitting in front, bespectacled and studious, to hear, and she wanted the girls gathered in the corridor outside to hear.
"Fact," Obinze said with a grin.
Because of her, he had joined the debate club, and after she spoke, he clapped the loudest and longest until her friend said, "Obinze, please, it's enough." Because of him, she joined the sports club and watched him play football, sitting by the touchline and holding his bottle of water. But it was table tennis that he loved, sweating and shouting as he played, glistening with energy, smashing the small white ball, and she marvelled at his skill, how he seemed to stand too far away from the table and yet managed to get the ball. He was already the undefeated school champion, as he had been, he told her, in his former school. When she played with him, he would laugh and say, "You don't win by hitting the ball with Angaru." Because of her, his friends called him Woman Rapper. Once, as he and his friends talked about meeting after school to play football, one of them asked, "Has Ifemelu given you permission to come?" And Obinze swiftly replied, "Yes, but she said I have only an hour." She liked that he wore their relationship so boldly, like a brightly colored shirt. Sometimes she worried that she was too happy. She would sink into moodiness and snap at Obinze or be distant, and her joy would become a restless thing, flapping its wings inside her, as though looking for an opening to fly away. Chapter 5. After Kayode's party, Ginnika was stilted. An alien awkwardness grew between them.
"You know, I didn't think it would happen that way," Ifemelu told her.
"Ifem, he was looking at you from the beginning," Ginnika said, and then to show that she was fine with it all, she teased Ifemelu about stealing her guy without even trying. Her breeziness was forced, laid on thickly, and Ifemelu felt burdened with guilt and with a desire to overcompensate. It seemed wrong that her close friend Ginnika, pretty, pleasant, popular Ginnika, with whom she had never quarrelled, was reduced to pretending that she did not care, even though a wistfulness underlined her tone whenever she talked about Obinze.
"Ifem, will you have time for us today, or is it Obinze all the way?" she would ask.
And so when Ginnika came to school one morning, her eyes red and shadowed, and told Ifemelu, "My popsy said we are going to America next month," Ifemelu felt almost relieved. She would miss her friend, but Ginnika's leaving forced them both to wring out their friendship and lay it out newly fresh to dry, to return to where they used to be. Ginnika's parents had been talking for a while about resigning from the university and starting over in America. Once while visiting, Ifemelu had heard Ginnika's father say,
"We are not sheep. This regime is treating us like sheep, and we are starting to behave as if we are sheep. I have not been able to do any real research in years, because every day I am organizing strikes and talking about unpaid salary, and there is no talk in the classrooms."
He was a small, dark man, smaller looking and darker looking beside Ginnika's large, ash-haired mother, with an undecided air about him, as though he was always dithering between choices. When Ifemelu told her own parents that Ginnika's family was finally leaving, her father sighed and said,
"At least they are fortunate to have that option."
But her mother said, They are blessed. But Ginnika complained and cried, painting images of a sad, friendless life in a strange America. I wish I could live with you people while they go, she told Ifemelu. They had gathered at Ginnika's house, Ifemelu, Ranyanudo, Priye, and Tochi, and were in her bedroom, picking through the clothes she would not be taking with her.
Ginnika, just make sure you can still talk to us when you come back, Priye said.
She'll come back and be a serious Americana, like Bisi,
Ranyanudo said. They roared with laughter at that word, Americana, wreathed in glee, the fourth syllable extended, and at the thought of Bisi, a girl in the form below them, who had come back from a short trip to America with odd affectations, pretending she no longer understood Yoruba, adding a slurred R to every English word she spoke.
Bankinika, seriously, I would give anything to be you right now, Priye said. I don't understand why you don't want to go. You can always come back.
At school, friends gathered around Ginnika. They all wanted to take her out to the tuck shop and to see her after school, as though her impending departure had made her even more desirable. Ifemelu and Ginnika were lounging in the corridor during short break when the big guys joined them. Kayode, Obinze, Ahmed, Emenike, and Osahon.
Ginnika, where in America are you going? Emenike asked.
He was awed by people who went abroad. After Kayode came back from a trip to Switzerland with his parents, Emenike had bent down to caress Kayode's shoes, saying, I want to touch them, because they have touched snow.
Missouri, Ginnika said. My dad got a teaching job there.
Your mother is an American, Abby, so you have an American passport, Emenike asked.
Yes, but we haven't traveled since I was in primary 3.
American passport is the coolest thing, Kayode said. I would exchange my British passport tomorrow.
Me too, Yinka said.
I very nearly had one, no? Obinze said. I was 8 months old when my parents took me to America. I keep telling my mom that she should have gone earlier and had me there.
Bad luck, man, Kayode said.
I don't have a passport. Last time we traveled, I was on my mom's passport, Ahmed said. I was on my mom's until primary 3. Then my dad said we needed to get our own passports, Osahon said.
I've never gone abroad, but my father has promised that I will go for university. I wish I could just apply for my visa now instead of waiting to finish school, Emenike said.
After he spoke, a hushed silence followed.
Don't leave us now. Wait until you finish, Yinka finally said, and she and Kayode burst out laughing.
The others laughed too, even Emenike himself, but there was underneath their laughter a barbed echo. They knew he was lying. Emenike, who made up stories of rich parents that everyone knew he didn't have, so immersed in his need to invent a life that was not his. The conversation ebbed, changed to the mathematics teacher, who did not know how to solve simultaneous equations. Obinze took Ifemelu's hand, and they drifted away. They did that often, slowly detaching themselves from their friends to sit in a corner by the library or take a walk on the green behind the laboratories. As they walked, she wanted to tell Obinze that she didn't know what it meant to be on your mother's passport, that her mother didn't even have a passport. But she said nothing, walking beside him in silence. He fitted here, in this school, much more than she did. She was popular, always on every party list and always announced during assembly as one of the first 3 in her class, yet she felt sheathed in a translucent haze of difference. She would not be here if she had not done so well on the entrance examination, if her father had not been determined that she would go to a school that builds both character and career. Her primary school had been different, full of children like her, whose parents were teachers and civil servants, who took the bus and did not have drivers. She remembered the surprise on Obinze's face, a surprise he had quickly shielded, when he asked,
"What's your phone number?"
And she replied, "We don't have a phone." He was holding her hand now, squeezing gently. He admired her for being outspoken and different, but he did not seem able to see beneath that. To be here among people who had gone abroad was natural for him. He was fluent in the knowledge of foreign things, especially of American things. Everybody watched American films and exchanged faded American magazines, but he knew details about American presidents from 100 years ago. Everybody watched American shows, but he knew about Lisa Bonet leaving The Cosby Show to go and do Angel Heart, and Will Smith's huge debts before he was signed to do The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
"You look like a black American,"
was his ultimate compliment, which he told her when she wore a nice dress or when her hair was done in large braids. Manhattan was his zenith. He often said,
"It's not as if this is Manhattan,"
or "Go to Manhattan and see how things are." He gave her a copy of Huckleberry Finn, the pages creased from his thumbing, and she started reading it on the bus home but stopped after a few chapters. The next morning she put it down on his desk with a decided thump.
"Unreadable nonsense," she said.
"It's written in different American dialects," Obinze said.
"And so what? I still don't understand it."
"You have to be patient, Ifem.
If you really get into it, it's very interesting and you won't want to stop reading."
"I've already stopped reading. Please keep your proper books and leave me with the books I like. And by the way, I still win when we play Scrabble, Mr. Read Proper Books."
Now she slipped her hand from his as they walked back to class. Whenever she felt this way, panic would slice into her at the slightest thing, and mundane events would become arbiters of doom. This time, Ginnica was the trigger. She was standing near the staircase, her backpack on her shoulder, her face gold-streaked in the sunlight, and suddenly Ifemelu thought how much Ginnica and Obinze had in common. Ginnica's house at the University of Lagos, the quiet bungalow, the yard crowned by bougainvillea hedges, was perhaps like Obinze's house in Nsoka, and she imagined Obinze realizing how better suited Ginnica was for him, and then this joy, this fragile, glimmering thing between them, would disappear. Obinze told her one morning after assembly that his mother wanted her to visit.
"Your mother?" she asked him agape.
"I think she wants to meet her future daughter-in-law."
"Obinze, be serious."
"I remember in primary 6, I took this girl to the send-off party, and my mom dropped both of us off and gave the girl a handkerchief.
She said, 'A lady always needs a handkerchief.'
My mother can be strange. Maybe she wants to give you a handkerchief."
"Obinze Madueti."
"She's never done this before, but then I've never had a serious girlfriend before. I think she just wants to see you. She said you should come to lunch."
Ifemelu stared at him. What sort of mother in her right mind asked her son's girlfriend to visit? It was odd. Even the expression, "come to lunch," was something people said in books. If you were boyfriend and girlfriend, you did not visit each other's homes. You registered for after-school lessons, for French club, for anything that could mean seeing each other outside school. Her parents did not, of course, know about Obinze. Obinze's mother's invitation frightened and excited her. For days, she worried about what to wear.
"Just be yourself," Auntie Uju told her,
and Ifemelu replied, "How can I just be myself? What does that even mean?" On the afternoon she visited, she stood outside the door of their flat for a while before she pressed the bell, suddenly and wildly hoping that they had gone out. Obinze opened the door.
"Hi, my mom just came back from work."
The living room was airy, the walls free of photographs except for a turquoise painting of a long-necked woman in a turban.
"That's the only thing that is ours. Everything else came with a flat," Obinze said.
"It's nice," she mumbled.
"Don't be nervous. Remember, she wants you here,"
Obinze whispered, just before his mother appeared. She looked like Onye Kaunwenu. The resemblance was astounding. A full-nosed, full-lipped beauty, her round face framed by a low afro, her faultless complexion the deep brown of cocoa. Onye Kaunwenu's music had been one of the luminous joys of Ifemelu's childhood, and had remained undimmed in the aftermath of childhood. She would always remember the day her father came home with a new album, In the Morning Light. Onye Kaunwenu's face on it was a revelation, and for a long time she traced that photo with her finger. The songs, each time her father played them, made their flat festive, turned him into a looser person who sang along with songs steeped in femaleness, and Ifemelu would guiltily fantasize about him being married to Onyeka Onwenu instead of to her mother. When she greeted Obinze's mother with a "Good afternoon, ma," she almost expected her in response to break into song in a voice as peerless as Onyeka Onwenu's. But she had a low, murmuring voice.
"What a beautiful name you have, Ifemelu Nama," she said.
Ifemelu stood tongue-tied for seconds. "Thank you, ma."
"Translate it,"
she said.
"Translate?" "Yes. How would you translate your name? Did Obinze tell you I do some translation?"
"From the French. I'm a lecturer in literature. Not English literature, mind you, but literatures in English. And my translating is something I do as a hobby.
Now translating your name from Igbo to English might be Made in Good Times or Beautifully Made. What do you think?"
Ifemelu could not think. There was something about the woman that made her want to say intelligent things, but her mind was blank.
"Mommy, she came to greet you, not to translate her name,"
Obinze said with a playful exasperation.
"Do we have a soft drink to offer our guest? Did you bring out the soup from the freezer?"
"Let's go to the kitchen," his mother said. She reached out and picked off a piece of lint from his hair, and then hit his head lightly. Their fluid bantering rapport made Ifemelu uncomfortable. It was free of restraint, free of the fear of consequences. It did not take the familiar shape of a relationship with a parent. They cooked together, his mother stirring the soup, Obinze making the gari, while Ifemelu stood by drinking a Coke. She had offered to help, but his mother had said,
"No, my dear, maybe next time,"
as though she did not just let anyone help in her kitchen. She was pleasant and direct, even warm, but there was a privacy about her, a reluctance to bare herself completely to the world, the same quality as Obinze. She had taught her son the ability to be, even in the middle of a crowd, somehow comfortably inside himself.
"What are your favorite novels, Ifemelu Nama?"
his mother asked.
"You know Obinze will only read American books. I hope you're not that foolish."
"Mommy, you're just trying to force me to like this book." He gestured to the book on the kitchen table, Graham Greene's The Heart of the Matter.
"My mother reads this book twice a year. I don't know why,"
he said to Ifemelu.
"It is a wise book. The human stories that matter are those that endure. The American books you read are lightweight."
She turned to Ifemelu.
"This boy is too besotted with America." "I read American books because America is the future, mommy. And remember that your husband was educated there."
"That was when only dullards went to school in America. American universities were considered to be at the same level as British secondary schools then. I did a lot of brushing up on that man after I married him."
"Even though you left your things in his flat so that his other girlfriends would stay away?"
"I've told you not to pay any attention to your uncle's false stories." Ifemelu stood there mesmerized. Obinze's mother, her beautiful face, her air of sophistication, her wearing a white apron in the kitchen, was not like any other mother Ifemelu knew. Here, her father would seem crass with his unnecessary big words, and her mother provincial and small.
"You can wash your hands at the sink," Obinze's mother told her. "I think the water is still running."
They sat at the dining table, eating gari and soup, Ifemelu trying hard to be, as Auntie Uju had said, herself, although she was no longer sure what herself was. She felt undeserving, unable to sink with Obinze and his mother into their atmosphere.
"The soup is very sweet, ma," she said politely.
"Oh, Obinze cooked it," his mother said.
"Didn't he tell you that he cooks?"
"Yes, but I didn't think he could make soup, ma," Ifemelu said.
Obinze was smirking. "Do you cook at home?"
his mother asked. Ifemelu wanted to lie to say that she cooked and loved cooking, but she remembered Auntie Uju's words.
"No, ma," she said. "I don't like cooking. I can eat indomie noodles day and night."
His mother laughed, as though charmed by the honesty. And when she laughed, she looked like a softer-faced Obinze. Ifemelu ate her food slowly, thinking how much she wanted to remain there with them, in their rapture, forever. Their flat smelled of vanilla on weekends, when Obinze's mother baked. Slices of mango glistening on a pie, small brown cakes swelling with raisins. Ifemelu stirred the batter and peeled the fruit. Her own mother did not bake. Their oven housed cockroaches.
Obinze just said trunk, ma. He said it's in the trunk of your car, she said.
In their America-Britain jousting, she always sided with his mother.
Trunk is a part of a tree, and not a part of a car, my dear son, his mother said.
When Obinze pronounced schedule with the K sound, his mother said,
Ifemelu nama, please tell my son, I don't speak American. Could you say that in English?
On weekends, they watched films on video. They sat in the living room, eyes on the screen, and Obinze said,
Mommy, chilu, let's hear.
When his mother from time to time gave her commentary on the plausibility of a scene, or the foreshadowing, or whether an actor was wearing a wig. One Sunday, midway into a film, his mother left for the pharmacy to buy her allergy medicine.
I'd forgotten they close early today, she said.
As soon as her car engine started, a dull revving, Ifemelu and Obinze hurried to his bedroom and sank onto his bed, kissing and touching, their clothing rolled up, shifted aside, pulled halfway, their skin warm against each other. They left the door and the window louvers open, both of them alert to the sound of his mother's car. In a sluice of seconds, they were dressed, back in the living room, play pressed on the video recorder. Obinze's mother walked in and glanced at the TV.
You were watching this scene when I left, she said quietly. A frozen silence fell, even from the film.
Then the sing-song cries of a beans hawker floated in through the window.
Ifemelu nama, please come,
his mother said, turning to go inside. Obinze got up, but Ifemelu stopped him.
No, she called me.
His mother asked her to come inside her bedroom, asked her to sit on the bed.
If anything happens between you and Obinze, you are both responsible. But nature is unfair to women. An act is done by two people, but if there are any consequences, one person carries it alone. Do you understand me?
Yes. Ifemelu kept her eyes averted from Obinze's mother, firmly fixed on the black and white linoleum on the floor.
Have you done anything serious with Obinze?
No.
I was once young. I know what it is like to love while young. I want to advise you. I am aware that in the end you will do what you want. My advice is that you wait. You can love without making love. It is a beautiful way of showing your feelings, but it brings responsibility. Great responsibility. And there is no rush. I will advise you to wait until you are at least in the university. Wait until you own yourself a little more. Do you understand?
Yes, Ifemelu said. She did not know what own yourself a little more meant.
I know you are a clever girl. Women are more sensible than men, and you will have to be the sensible one. Convince him. Both of you should agree to wait so that there is no pressure.
Obinze's mother paused, and Ifemelu wondered if she had finished. The silence rang in her head. Thank you, ma, Ifemelu said. And when you want to start, I want you to come and see me. I want to know that you are being responsible. Ifemelu nodded. She was sitting on Obinze's mother's bed, in the woman's bedroom, nodding and agreeing to tell her when she started having sex with her son. Yet she felt the absence of shame. Perhaps it was Obinze's mother's tone, the evenness of it, the normalness of it.
Thank you, ma, Ifemelu said again, now looking at Obinze's mother's face, which was open, no different from what it usually was.
I will. She went back to the living room. Obinze seemed nervous, perched on the edge of the center table.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to talk to her about this when you leave. If she wants to talk to anybody, it should be me.
She said, I should never come here again, that I am misleading her son. Obinze blinked.
What?
Ifemelu laughed. Later, when she told him what his mother had said, he shook his head.
We have to tell her when we start. What kind of rubbish is that? Does she want to buy condoms for us? What is wrong with that woman?
But who told you we are ever going to start anything?
Chapter 6. During the week, Auntie Uju hurried home to shower and wait for the general, and on weekends she lounged in her nightdress, reading or cooking or watching television, because the general was in Abuja with his wife and children. She avoided the sun and used creams in elegant bottles so that her complexion, already naturally light, became lighter, brighter, and took on a sheen. Sometimes, as she gave instructions to her driver, Sola, or her gardener, Baba Flower, or her two house helps, Inyang, who cleaned, and Chikodili, who cooked, Ifemelu would remember Auntie Uju, the village girl, brought to Lagos so many years ago, who Ifemelu's mother mildly complained was so parochial she kept touching the walls, and what was it with all those village people who could not stand on their feet without reaching out to smear their palm on a wall? Ifemelu wondered if Auntie Uju ever looked at herself with the eyes of the girl she used to be. Perhaps not. Auntie Uju had steadied herself into her new life with a lightness of touch more consumed by the general himself than by her new wealth. The first time Ifemelu saw Auntie Uju's house in Dolphin Estate, she did not want to leave. The bathroom fascinated her, with its hot water tap, its gushing shower, its pink tiles. The bedroom curtains were made of raw silk, and she told Auntie Uju, it's a waste to use this material as a curtain. Let's sew a dress with it. The living room had glass doors that slid noiselessly open and noiselessly shut. Even the kitchen was air-conditioned. She wanted to live there. It would impress her friends. She imagined them sitting in the small room just off the living room, which Auntie Uju called the TV room, watching programs on satellite. And so she asked her parents if she could stay with Auntie Uju during the week. It's closer to school. I won't need to take two buses. I can go on Mondays and come home on Fridays, Ifemelu said. I can also help Auntie Uju in the house.
My understanding is that Uju has sufficient help, her father said.
It's a good idea, her mother said to her father. She can study well there. At least there will be light every day. No need for her to study with kerosene lamps.
She can visit Uju after school and on weekends, but she is not going to live there, her father said.
Her mother paused, taken aback by his firmness.
Okay, she said, with a helpless glance at Ifemelu.
For days, Ifemelu sulked. Her father often indulged her, giving in to what she wanted, but this time he ignored her pouts, her deliberate silences at the dinner table. He pretended not to notice when Auntie Uju brought them a new television. He settled back in his well-worn sofa, reading his well-worn book, while Auntie Uju's driver put down the brown Sony carton. Ifemelu's mother began to sing a church song. The Lord has given me victory. I will lift him higher, which was often sung at collection time. The general bought more than I needed in the house. There was nowhere to put this one, Auntie Uju said, a general statement made to nobody in particular, a way of shrugging off thanks. Ifemelu's mother opened the carton, gently stripped away the styrofoam packaging.
Our old one doesn't even show anything anymore, she said,
although they all knew that it still did.
Look how slim it is, she added. Look!
Her father raised his eyes from the book.
Yes, it is, he said,
and then lowered his gaze. The landlord came again. He barged past Ifemelu into the flat, into the kitchen, and reached up to the electric meter, yanking off the fuse, cutting off what little electricity they had. After he left, Ifemelu's father said,
What ignominy! To ask us for 2 years' rent. We have been paying 1 year.
But even that 1 year, we have not paid, her mother said, and in her tone was the slightest of accusations.
I've spoken to Akunne about a loan, her father said.
He disliked Akunne, his almost cousin, the prosperous man from their hometown to whom everyone took their problems. He called Akunne a lurid illiterate, a money misrode.
What did he say?
He said I should come and see him this Friday.
His fingers were unsteady. He was struggling, it seemed, to suppress emotions. Ifemelu hastily looked away, hoping he had not seen her watching him, and asked him if he could explain a difficult question in her homework, to distract him, to make it seem that life could happen again. Her father would not ask Auntie Uju for help, but if Auntie Uju presented him with money, he would not refuse. It was better than being indebted to Akunne. Ifemelu told Auntie Uju how the landlord banged on their door, a loud, unnecessary banging for the benefit of the neighbors, while hurling insults at her father.
Are you not a real man? Pay me my money. I will throw you out of this flat if I don't get that rent by next week.
As Ifemelu mimicked the landlord, a wan sadness crossed Auntie Uju's face.
How can that useless landlord embarrass brother like this? I'll ask Oga to give me the money.
Ifemelu stopped. You don't have money?
My account is almost empty, but Oga will give it to me. And you know I have not been paid a salary since I started work. Every day there is a new story from the accounts people. The trouble started with my position that does not officially exist, even though I see patients every day.
But doctors are on strike, Ifemelu said.
The military hospitals still pay. Not that my pay will be enough for the rent, sha?
You don't have money? Ifemelu asked again, slowly, to clarify, to be sure.
Auntie, but how can you not have money? Uga never gives me big money. He pays all the bills and he wants me to ask for everything I need. Some men are like that.
Ifemelu stared. Auntie Uju in her big pink house, with the wide satellite dish blooming from its roof, her generator brimming with diesel, her freezer stocked with meat, and she did not have money in her bank account.
Ifem, don't look as if somebody died.
Auntie Uju laughed her wry laugh. She looked suddenly small and bewildered among the detritus of her new life, the fawn-coloured jewel case on the dressing table, the silk robe thrown across the bed, and Ifemelu felt frightened for her.
He even gave me a little more than I asked for, Auntie Uju told Ifemelu the next weekend, with a small smile, as though amused by what the general had done. We'll go to the house from the salon so I can give it to brother.
It startled Ifemelu how much a relaxer retouching cost at Auntie Uju's hair salon. The haughty hairdressers sized up each customer, eyes swinging from head to shoes, to decide how much attention she was worth. With Auntie Uju, they hovered and grovelled, curtsying deeply as they greeted her, overpraising her handbag and shoes. Ifemelu watched, fascinated. It was here, at a Lagos salon, that the different ranks of imperial femaleness were best understood.
Those girls, I was waiting for them to bring out their hands and beg you to shit so they could worship that too, Ifemelu said, as they left the salon.
Auntie Uju laughed and patted the silky hair extensions that fell to her shoulders. Chinese weave-on, the latest version, shiny and straight as straight could be. It never tangled.
You know we live in an ass-licking economy. The biggest problem in this country is not corruption. The problem is that there are many qualified people who are not where they are supposed to be because they won't lick anybody's ass, or they don't know which ass to lick, or they don't even know how to lick an ass. I'm lucky to be licking the right ass.
She smiled. It's just luck. Oga said I was well brought up, that I was not like all the Lagos girls who sleep with him on the first night, and the next morning give him a list of what they want him to buy. I slept with him on the first night, but I did not ask for anything, which was stupid of me now that I think of it, but I did not sleep with him because I wanted something. Ah, this thing called power. I was attracted to him, even with his teeth like Dracula. I was attracted to his power.
Auntie Uju liked to talk about the general. Different versions of the same stories, repeated and savored. Her driver had told her. She swayed his loyalty by arranging his wife's prenatal visits and his baby's immunizations, that the general asked for details of where she went and how long she stayed, and each time Auntie Uju told Ifemelu the story, she would end with a sigh.
Does he think I can't see another man without him knowing?
if I wanted to, but I don't want to. They were in the cold interior of the Mazda. As the driver backed out of the gates of the salon compound, Auntie Uju gestured to the gateman, rolled down her window, and gave him some money.
Thank you, madame,
he said, and saluted. She had slipped Naira notes to all the salon workers, to the security men outside, to the policeman at the road junction. They are not paid enough to afford school fees for even one child, Auntie Uju said.
That small money you gave him will not help him pay any school fees, Ifemelu said.
But he can buy a little extra something, and he will be in a better mood, and he won't beat his wife this night,
Auntie Uju said. She looked out of the window and said,
Slow down, Shola,
so that she could get a good look at an accident on Osborne Road. A bus had hit a car. The front of the bus and the back of the car were now mangled metal, and both drivers were shouting in each other's faces, buffered by a gathering crowd.
Where do they come from? These people that appear once there's an accident.
Auntie Uju leaned back in her seat.
Do you know I've forgotten what it feels like to be in a bus? It is so easy to get used to all this.
You can just go to Falamo now and get on a bus, Ifemelu said.
But it won't be the same. It's never the same when you have other choices.
Auntie Uju looked at her.
Ifem, stop worrying about me.
I'm not worrying.
You've been worrying since I told you about my account.
If somebody else was doing this, you would say she was stupid.
I would not even advise you to do what I'm doing.
Auntie Uju turned back to the window.
He'll change. I'll make him change. I just need to go slowly.
At the flat, Auntie Uju handed Ifemelu's father a plastic bag, swollen with cash.
It's rent for 2 years, brother, she said,
with an embarrassed casualness, and then made a joke about the hole in his singlet. She did not look him in the face as she spoke, and he did not look her in the face as he thanked her. The general had yellowed eyes, which suggested to Ifemelu a malnourished childhood. His solid, thick-set body spoke of fights that he had started and won, and the buck teeth that gaped through his lips made him seem vaguely dangerous. Ifemelu was surprised by the gleeful coarseness of him.
I'm a village man,
he said happily, as though to explain the drops of soup that landed on his shirt and on the table while he ate, or his loud burping afterwards. He arrived in the evenings in his green uniform, holding a gossip magazine or two, while his ADC, at an obsequious pace behind him, brought his briefcase and put it on the dining table. He rarely left with the gossip magazines. Copies of Vintage People and Prime People and Lagos Life littered Auntie Uju's house with their blurry photos and garish headlines.
If I tell you what these people do, eh?
Auntie Uju would say to Ifemelu, tapping at a magazine photograph with her French manicured nail.
Their real stories are not even in the magazines. Olga has the real gist.
Then she would talk about the man who had sex with a top general to get an oil block, the military administrator whose children were fathered by somebody else, the foreign prostitutes flown in weekly for the head of state. She repeated the stories with affectionate amusement, as though she thought the general's keenness on raunchy gossip was a charming and forgivable indulgence.
Do you know, he is afraid of injections. A whole general officer commanding, and if he sees a needle, he's afraid,
Auntie Uju said, in the same tone. It was to her an endearing detail. Ifemelu could not think of the general as endearing, with his loud, boorish manner, the way he reached out to slap Auntie Uju's backside as they went upstairs, saying,
All this for me? All this for me?
And the way he talked and talked, never acknowledging an interruption until he finished a story. One of his favourites, which he often told Ifemelu while drinking star beer after dinner, was the story of how Auntie Uju was different. He told it with a self-congratulatory tone, as if her difference reflected his own good taste.
The first time, I told her I was going to London, and asked what she wanted. She gave me a list. Before I looked at it, I said I already know what she wants. Is it now perfume, shoes, bags, watch and clothes? I know Lagos girls. But you know what was in it? One perfume and four books. I was shocked. Chai! I spent one good hour in that bookshop in Piccadilly. I bought her 20 books. Which Lagos babe do you know that will be asking for books?
Auntie Uju would laugh, suddenly girlish and pliant. Ifemelu would smile dutifully. She thought it undignified and irresponsible, this old married